Good day, and welcome to episode 30 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. In this episode, we'll look at the topic, how do Indigenous governance systems and settler governance systems clash? What are the consequences and lessons to be learned of this fundamental colonial conflict? And what are the implications for us as individuals and as a community? Our special guests are Skylar Williams, spokesperson for 1492 Land Back Lane, and Guelph's own local Indigenous advocate, Bruce Weaver. It was an enlightening conversation, and we're hoping it can serve as a call to action. It's important to note that the views in this conversation are not the only views of Indigenous community members and right holders in this territory. Here's our moderator, Dustin Brown.
Hi, everyone. It's January 28th, 2021. It's a Thursday, and that means we're up bright and early for this week's Breezy Breakfast. Most of us today are broadcasting from treaty territory of the Mississaugas of the Credit, established between the Mississaugas and the Crown under Treaty Number 3 in 1792. This territory is also under the Dish with One Spoon Covenant, which was established between Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabeg nations and was meant to apply to all other nations who have come to this land thereafter. Many of the Mississaugas and other Indigenous peoples who traditionally occupied this land have been displaced by this area by Canada's violent colonial nation building project. Indigenous people of various nationalities, including First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, still reside here, including some of us who are here today. And every day, they are asserting their inherent and treaty rights and responsibilities with resistance from the Canadian state and private interests, making colonization not just a historical matter, but rather one that is still ongoing. And that means that the act of decolonization is also one that is still ongoing, one that each of us can choose to participate in. I argue that it's everyone's shared responsibility to learn and contextualize what's shared by Indigenous knowledge keepers, historians, and activists, and to organize our efforts against all systems of oppression so that we can work together towards a better future for everyone. Today, we're really honored to have the chance to talk to Skylar Williams and Bruce Weaver about some of the work that they've each done relating to Indigenous governance. Skylar is a spokesperson for 1492 Land Back Lane, which is an occupation of Six Nations territory that has been going on for, I think, the majority of the pandemic. We're really looking forward to Skylar's presentation today and learning from his experience as a land defender. Bruce Weaver, a member of the Seven Generations Forward Council, is also with us, and he's going to tell us about his experience dealing with the city of Guelph. Throughout this discussion, I'm hoping that we can collectively reflect on the Land Back movement, which is just the newest name for a centuries-long decolonization struggle, as well as the conflicts of Indigenous governance systems and their counterparts in settler society, whether that's at the municipal, provincial, or federal level. So with that, I am going to invite Skylar to present first. Skylar, whenever you're ready, you can please take it away. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody. And yeah, no, we are at day 193 today of the peaceful occupation of our lands. We came in here on July 19th. It was quite a bit different when we first got here. I mean, it was 40 degrees in the shade when we first arrived. And so now, as I look around, as the sun is coming up, I don't know how well we can see as I'm sitting in my truck here, as the lands around us are now covered in snow and ice all the way around. So it's the landscape has changed a little bit over the last 6 months. But yeah, no, there was a group of us. There's, I think, about 15 of us in a dozen cars that went in there on the very first day on July 19th. We did our very, very best to maintain this as a peaceful occupation of our lands. And so everything that we could do, we've done quite deliberately to make sure that we could maintain it as a peaceful occupation. And so when we came in on July 19th, it was on a Sunday evening, to ensure there was going to be nobody from the developer there. We came in at dinner time, like it was about 5-6 o'clock in the evening, and we sat down and made our camp. You know, we built a fire, we set up a tent or two, and you know, I think for some of us, we weren't quite sure what to expect from the cops right away, but the cops did show up about 2 or 3 hours later, after we had eaten dinner, and we were all just kind of sitting by the fire laughing, and the cops came in. They asked us on the very first day, like, what we were doing, and I said, and we told them, and he said, well, how long do you expect on being here? And I kind of laughed to myself, and I said, well, our people have been here for the last 10,000 years. You know, I think we're planning on being here for the next 10. And he said, and so you're going to be here for a while, he said. And we kind of had a chuckle, and I shook his hand, and he left. That was July 19th, you know, and we, you know, start building our camp and, you know, putting up tents. And so there was a couple of weeks of just doing that, and the developer in the meantime had sought an injunction through the court here in Cayuga, which is like just the next town over, all in the same county, and they got their injunction without notice to us. The judge granted that, and the cops came in on August 5th. They called in the morning, and they said they I'd given them my number that very first day. And they called me in the morning and said that they had some additional information to give about the injunction. And so as we went up to the end of the roadway to see just what it is that was going on, we seen just this massive line of like 15 passenger vans coming down the road in the distance. And it was maybe 20 or 30 vans and another 20 or 30 police cars and trucks, and they all came up to the front of the site and started exiting the vehicle. As the sheriff had got there, he started reading the injunction. Somebody came out and said, you know, it's time to leave, or you're going to be arrested. And they said, you'll have 10 minutes or so. And so a bunch of us went back into the camp and had a discussion about what it is we were going to do. And it had been 17 days at that point. And the cops, a couple of minutes later, started advancing into the camp. And so we just all kind of stayed together as best as we could. And the cops started arresting people. There was 9 arrests that day, including myself. After that, I went to jail. I spent the day in lockup, and I ended up being released without bail or anything. I was just released on my own recognizance. Yeah, I got out of the cells there and got fingerprinted and got let go. And as I come out the door, this woman came up to me and stuck a phone in my face, and she said, "Do you know what's going on the ground down there?" And I didn't recognize her, and I was trying to look past her phone, but she kept insisting that I look at the phone. And there was just people's live feeds on their Facebooks and whatever that was showing. You know, there was a fire on the road, and there was Highway 6 had been blocked, and there was a train that was stopped, and there was lots of people trying to secure passage for us back to Land Back Lane. So that day we seen, you know, a few hundred people come out to make sure that we got back on the land there. And the OP, when I got back down there, we all got together and like made a decision, like, you know, all of these roads were blocked and everything was as it was. And so we said, well, we're going to go back to our tents. We're going back to the Land Back Lane. And so we went and told the cops. Cops were a little bit skittish at first. And I said, we're going to go back over there. And he said, well, you can't do that. There's like all of our guys are there. I said, oh, I just don't care. you guys need to leave. You guys need to leave now. And so we made the trek back over to Landback Lane, which is, you know, not very far of a drive. It's, you know, a 2-minute drive. But again, like it was on the very first day, there was, you know, I think there was maybe 30 of us this time, but, and, you know, 20 cars, and everybody just jumped in their cars and drove over, drove back on the land there. And those were the only 4 hours, 5 hours that, you know, our people haven't been on the land there in the last 193 days today. On October 22nd of this, of last year there, the police came up to, we had built a trail through the bush to be able to get the land back, so we didn't have to drive through all the way around on the roads where the police were. And so we went over to come in here, and there was a couple of cruisers sitting there, a couple of like SUVs, and had four cops in each of them, and several people had approached them, and like just community folks that weren't involved in stuff, that just they seen these cops sitting there and thought that it was not a good place for them to sit, that it was inciting something, that, you know, like you guys had just shot at people, you know, like on August 5th, they had shot rubber bullets at people. They had tasered, one guy got tasered in the neck and head. Another guy got dragged along the pavement. He's got scars on his face. He'll have them forever, like from getting his face dragged along the pavement. And, you know, and so people were still quite upset by that. They went there, they went to that back, our trail, and tried to arrest people. And so one guy got shot in the back with a rubber bullet. Another guy got tasered in the back as they ran. There was two of them, and they both got shot, one with a rubber bullet and one with a taser. And we were able to push them off the land and or push them off the road and get them out of here. And a lot of folks from community thought that that was by far too much. And so all of those barricades that were up in August, well, they went right back up again. And so that response from our community to say, like, absolutely not, like folks on the ground that are and have been peacefully occupying our lands for months and months and months, like, we've never been the ones to instigate any of this violence that's been done here. And these roadblocks that have been up for on Argyle Street and Mackenzie Road and Highway 6, like, these have all been in response to that massive, because like when they came in on us, it was 100 OPP officers to arrest 9 people, 100 OPP officers with these rubber bullet guns that, you know, they like, I'm a hunter, and I've, you know, and I know what a 12 gauge shotgun looks like, and that's what it looked like. And so, you know, nobody yells out first that, you know, these are rubber bullets that we're shooting at you. They just open fire. And so for them to do that yet again was, you know, just absolutely horrible. In the meantime, all of that stuff was going on. We were fighting our civil case against the injunction. The injunction that seen a judge in Haldimand County, Ontario, grant a permanent injunction against all the Six Nations people, but I was the sole name party in that. And they struck every bit of evidence that we put. We had a ton of support and an amazing legal team that was able to put lots and lots of work together in order to make, quite honestly, make me sound a lot smarter than I actually am. Like, I'm quite lucky to have some of the most amazing, smart people around me that, you know, like, have done just a tremendous amount of work and lifted a lot of the weight for me to be able to defend myself. And so generally what they would do is just put these massive packages of case law and process and all of it together for me in a binder. And I'd go in, I'd pick it up every day, and I'd come back to the land, sit on the land, and just go through and read all of the stuff. And then once I got done reading, I'd read it again. And so it became and became part of, you know, top of mind. And so we were able to mount a pretty good case against them. But because the judge saw that me violating the injunction meant that I wasn't ever going to abide any order that he made, he said that I was barred from participating in any of my defense. I was abusing the process by trying to participate in it, and struck any evidence that I had from the record, as well as granting a what was an interim interlocutory injunction now became a permanent injunction. It went about as bad as it could have possibly gone, but it also highlighted for us all of the very stark racism and systemic issues that we've talked about with GLADU within the court system for the last, 15, 20 years, about this massive divide between Indigenous people and the courts. You know, and that context has only been kind of talked about within law around the how to deal with us when it comes to being in jail or bail. But in the civil context, like, we're talking about this, we weren't even allowed to hire lawyers until the 60s. There's a divide there that continues today because our people have never been represented in those systems. So fast forward to today, where are we at today? We are trying to push the feds in the province to come to the table with some kind of meaningful negotiations to start some kind of discussions to be able to have some of that meaningful dialogue that needs to happen before development happens, not after somebody stands up and says no. Today, most of the roads kind of surrounding our camp are still blocked. Mackenzie Road is still blocked and Argyle Street is still blocked. But the Highway 6 bypass that borders our reserve has been opened, and the police have been pushing for an emergency services route for weeks and weeks and weeks. And so we granted that and said, absolutely, let's make that happen. And then we opened the road up and absolutely nothing from them, not a thing. There hasn't been a move one way or the other to open the road up, to get any, get the MTO in there to inspect anything, and then have talked about, because that road was under construction when it got blocked. And so because the road was under construction, now the MTO is saying that, or the OPP is saying to the media that it's going to take 6 to 8 weeks because of damage that was done to the road. Absolutely, there was damage done to the road, absolutely. By us, absolutely. The road that, like, we're talking about a day, maybe 2 days work to fix anything that we did. The damage that, or the 6 to 8 weeks of work that they're talking about is stuff that is part of that ongoing construction that was already happening on those roads. What else we got going on? We got lots of community stuff going on. We've got a survey going out to community, talking to them, and because we're not allowed to have big gatherings right now, we've cranked out a survey both in, we have two kind of local papers on reserve, but that both those we've put that out online. There is, and again, like, for folks, if folks want to look at that, you can look at our 1492 Land Back Lane page on Facebook. I think it's on our Twitter and our Instagram as well. And, you know, if people want to fill out the survey for, you know, like, because, like, that's the thing, is for us to be able to show community also that we have a lot of outside support as well as within community. And so that part's really important. Yeah, I think that's about as close as an update as I can get. So.
Cool, thank you, Tyler. I have a quick question for you, if it's okay, and I'll have a lot more questions for you afterwards, but just for those in the audience who might not know kind of what inspired the action here, what is 1492 Land Back Lane about? What is it in response to?
So yeah, this particular development that we stopped, it rolls up right directly across. I think most folks will remember 2006 reclamation of Gunnestado. And so this, that for me anyway, I, on a very personal level, like that one for me was a year of my life there and 7 months in jail for that. And that's still occupied today, 15 years later. It's almost in a few weeks, it'll be the 15th anniversary of that. And so this particular development rolls up 1,400 homes directly across the street from that development that we reclaimed in 2006. And so, yeah, it is a massive, massive development, kind of right on the doorstep of our community. And so, like, I think that was one of the things that we've been saying from this. Like, we're not talking about going up and down the Grand River with eviction notices. We're talking about securing lands for our future that we can expand our borders. Like, this isn't something that we're looking to say, you know, everybody needs to vacate the entirety of the Grand River Tract. We're saying that if there's vacant lands, certainly on the doorstep of our community, that we need to have every opportunity given to folks from Six Nations to be able to acquire those lands so that our community and for that those lands to then become part of the reserve. So there's a reserve, an additions to reserve process that is absolutely ridiculous. It is one that has never worked anywhere in the country. Like, while every other big city, every other small town across the country has grown exponentially in the last 100 years, the only ones that have the booming population and are the only ones that have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, and those are reserves. And so this idea that this was something that happened 200 years ago, that settlement was pushed on indigenous lands 200 years ago, 150 years ago, it wasn't. This is something that is happening today. We're talking about the Planning Act and the Places to Grow Act, that green belt that just is just to the east of the Grand River. That green belt stops at 10 miles or 10 kilometers, 6 miles from the Grand River. And it incentivizes development, massive developments along the Grand River Tract. And so this incentivizing settlers to come in, settle along the banks of the Grand River isn't something from 200 years ago. This is something that is being done today.
Yeah, absolutely. And in so many more ways than just that one as well. Thanks, Skylar. And like I said, we're going to come back to you with more questions, but not before Bruce gives his presentation. So Bruce, whenever you're ready, you can go ahead, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Dustin. And thanks, Skylar, for a really great presentation. Much appreciated. I wanted to shift gears a bit and talk about how governance of a urban population looks and how it butts up against the city council and that municipal governance. And I'll give a bit of an overview, and then I want to give the example of the Sacred Fire and how that worked or not. And then we'll be ready for questions after that. So within the city, there is a fairly large population of indigenous peoples, but we come from all across Turtle Island. So it's not a homogenous group by any means. Within the circles I operate in, there are Mi'kmaq, Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, Cree, Métis, Innu, and at one time we had several people from the West Coast. So very mixed, coming with very different cultures, very different governance systems. And so within the circles I work with, we tend to look to a consensus model. And I use the word circle because that's how they work. We sit in circle, we talk in circle, so everyone has a voice, and there's no one person speaks for the group unless they, the circle says, please speak on our behalf. So when we come to a time when we need to talk to the city, we have a circle trying to fit within a pyramidal structure. Even though the city council may sit in a semicircle, you're not all equal within that semicircle. There is a hierarchy. And so it becomes interesting to try to fit that circle within the pyramid. And I think there's frustration on both sides because, of course, we all look at it from our own vantage point and say, well, why won't it work? Why doesn't it work? And it doesn't work because we're coming from different worldviews. So let me jump to the sacred fire and say that began as a discussion amongst some elders in the city. And they reminded a circle of us that about 25 years ago, they had asked the city for a sacred fire, or at least permission to have sacred fires. And they weren't interested in just a place, but actually the idea of that sacred fires were a part of our spiritual life, our day-to-day life, and were very necessary. They were rebuffed for a variety of reasons. Then they tried again about, maybe 10 years ago. A fire was allowed, and I say allowed. It was put off in one corner of Riverside Park, far from the maddening crowd, and it was a disaster. The circle talked about it and said, things seem to feel differently. And I said, well, there's a certain counselor that I know, and I will approach him and see if there's a way we can at least begin a discussion. So I went to James. We had a chat, and he suggested that I and he speak to the fire department. And we did. And we had this very interesting discussion about smudging. They were consumed with the idea that smudging meant huge fires inside a building, and they were aghast at the idea. And then when it came to a sacred fire, they had visions of a bonfire, and we had to disabuse them of that idea that a sacred fire can be as small as two twigs. It's the sacredness of the fire, not the size of it. I think I said at that point, we don't always need to shout for the creator to hear us. We can use something quite small. After a fairly lengthy discussion, the fire chief looked at his safety officers and said, so how can we make it happen? And that was a really changing point for me. Instead of obstruction, it was, how can we make it happen? But that was just the beginning. It was another year or more of talks, getting to know one another, introducing the idea of smudging at the beginning of each gathering, sitting in a circle, not in rows. In a way, very quietly indigenizing Parks and Rec. That finally led to a construction phase and eventually the sacred fire that we now have in Royal City Park. And I think the big thing, the things that I took from that were, it's about building a relationship first, foremost, second, third. It's all relationship building. Once you have the relationship, then you can get things done. Yes, there were some interesting moments. I can remember being asked, so finances, do you have a treasurer? No, we have envelopes with a bit of change and money in it that we can offer someone gas money when they're really needing it. But no, we don't have a treasurer. No, we don't have a CFO. No, we don't have a president. No, we don't have a chairman. No, we don't have a president. So then, of course, the question is, well, then who do we talk to? Well, you talk to whoever's available. And our circle that met with Parks and Rec varied. Sometimes we would bring in a firekeeper because we need the technical side of what makes a decent fire pit. What would a firekeeper want to see? Other times it was bring in an elder who can say, from a spiritual viewpoint, what is needed. Parks and Rec, after 2 years of this, were quite used to the fact that somebody would show up who had the right information for what was going to be discussed that day. And it didn't matter who it was, they were speaking for that circle. And that circle was trying its best to speak for the community. The things I drew from that were, in an urban population, there will never be consensus on who the leaders are. What the city needs to do, in my view, is to look for those who are willing and able to engage. I think there's another population within us who would like to engage, but don't have the skills or the understanding of how to do it. And for those, that group, I think we collectively need to figure out ways to engage that group and give them the opportunities to learn how to engage in a good way. There's another group that just want to get by. They will not engage. They're too busy trying to survive in the city. And I don't think we need to expect them to engage unless they're threatened, and then they will speak up. My takeaway, the city should deal with those who are ready, provide some help to those who need to learn how, and move on. Work with us. We're here. We're ready.
Okay, Bruce, thanks. And that's great, because I'm really looking forward to a really provocative and interesting discussion between all of us. Bruce, you submitted a question while Skylar was talking, so I just want to give Skylar the chance to answer it. And Skylar, the question was, can you talk a bit about your relationship with community? How do clans help or not help? Are they advisors in the occupation? And if you can relate that to hereditary chiefs and elected chief and council and anything else that comes to mind.
Yeah, absolutely I can. There are many functioning clans within Six Nations. There has been over the last, 50 years or so, 40 years, there's been a big pull to try to undo some of the work that the feds and the province have done to try and divide our community. And so those centuries and centuries, like for Haudenosaunee people, like the Great Law is like most conservative estimates put it around 1200 year old democracy. For us, absolutely, those clans meeting together and coming to us with help, with advice, with being able to maintain our presence on the land. Absolutely, those things are vitally important. The Confederacy Chiefs, the hereditary system here at Six Nations has been, one of our biggest supporters in all of this, to say, whatever we can do to help within our clans and nations, to be able to call on our brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews to come out and help out. Like they've been absolutely amazing. Within the elected system, it has been a bit more of a struggle with them. Granted, they were given an accommodation agreement with the developer here. They're scared they're going to get sued if they come out as supportive. To publicly support something that is defying court orders and all of the rest, like they're struggling around what that looks like for them to support. We actually have a meeting this afternoon with them, as well as Confederacy Council, the hereditary system, as well as the band council, to come to an understanding about what we can do with these negotiations with the feds and the province as a community, with one voice, to be able to say absolutely they're like development of our lands is not going to be tolerated any further. There's some movement there, and so we're encouraged by that.
Thanks, Scott. And yeah, there's definitely some long historical roots going back to the Indian Act and the elected system being forced on the Haudenosaunee Confederacy as well. I think, I don't remember the exact number, maybe you do, but I think only 11 people voted in the first election for elected chief and council.
Sometime. Yeah. Absolutely. And like in this past election was the biggest voter turnout that election council has ever seen. And that's 4.2% of the eligible voters come out to vote. And so they're quite proud of those numbers.
Yeah, that sounds like a situation that a certain country down south would be trying to delegitimize that election.
Absolutely, yes.
Maybe this country here too.
But, can I jump in here, Dustin? Sure. Yeah, just I think I can tell a brief story from Gunnis Ataque in 1923, and I think it was 1921 for six. The police came in and removed the hereditary chief and council and brought in elected chiefs. Well, at Gunnis Ataque, they shot the grand chief in that process, and they found five drunk gentlemen, put them in the room and said, decide amongst yourselves who will be chief and who will be counselors. And today, to this day in Gunnis Ataque, they say, well, that's our introduction to Canadian democracy.
Yeah, that's it. And it's, you know, a lot to do with the Canadian government couldn't deal with Indigenous governance. It couldn't, you know, force agreements and, you know, reach that hierarchical kind of arrangement that they needed to happen. I have a few more questions coming in the chat. Could either of you kind of clarify the difference between treaty and non-treaty? The question's phrased as, and why the agreements throughout Ontario, including Sauble, et cetera, are flawed. Any comments from either of you? Maybe Bruce, you want to go first this time?
Elected chiefs and council are responsible for the reserve. In a generalized way, you might think of them as middle managers taking the money from Ottawa and making sure it's distributed to cover the infrastructure and needs of the reserve community. Hereditary chiefs and clans, I would say more than councils, but hereditary chiefs and their clan mothers really are responsible for the traditional territory. So they have the broader view. To Skyler, what's your take?
Well, I mean, I think there's like a really broad context around like the treaty stuff. So like a lot of folks out west, way up north, weren't engaged at the start of, you know, the end of 1700s, early 1800s by the feds in the province. And so a lot of those communities just were just there. And so there was no agreements made between them and the state at the time. And so for those people, like when they talk about, you know, like the quote unquote unceded lands, like this is like those ones without those long lasting treaty arrangements that I know here in Six Nations that we have the Haldimand Proclamation, which is 1785, and grants, you know, 6 miles on either side of the river from the mouth of the source. I think they had, you know, never thought in 1785 that, you know, a quarter of the entire country would live in Southern Ontario, thinking that like in this place, the GROW Act, talking about, you know, pushing 15 million more people in the next 25 years into the Grand River Tract was going to happen. Yeah. But, you know, when a quarter of the entire country lives in one area, we're talking about the most lucrative bit of real estate that you're going to see anywhere. And so for us to be not even consulted with in any kind of meaningful way is, you know, for most of us is absolutely infuriating.
Cool. Thank you both. Mike Ashkway, you had a question that you sent in advance. And if you want, the floor is yours to voice it.
Hi guys. So yeah, as he mentioned, my name is Mike Ashkway. I'm Ojibwe, Chippewa of Nawash, originally from Cape Croker. So go me. So my question is related to some very broad things, but I think I'd love to hear your guys' insight into it. So what are your insights into how things are being handled with the 60s scoop settlement currently? A company known as Collectiva has been handling the administration of the settlement, and many claims are being left unresolved and not properly investigated due to provincial archives being closed down, etc. What can First Nations do to make sure we are heard to the proper levels of government, that our needs are not being met, and that undue harm is coming to our communities because of unnecessary delays? As of right now, I did get some updated stats last night. There were 34,000 claims that were made to the 60s scoop. They're actively investigating just a little under 10,000, I think. And because of COVID, they're not doing any rejections. And the claims are being processed ludicrously slowly. And it will take years for this settlement to get kind of dealt with. And in the midterm, people are dying of COVID. People are dying by suicide. I've heard, because I work with a group called the 60s Legacy, I think, or something along those lines. So forgive me about the proper name. But I would love to hear some insights from you guys, what we can do as First Nations to get heard by proper levels of government to get things moving. Because it seems like government from the colony side just doesn't want to get involved in our quote unquote stuff because it's our problem, but they kind of caused it. So insights, thoughts, everything appreciated. So thank you very much.
There's a lot to unpack there, but I think a lot of it boils down, at least for me anyways, to this mindset around these colonial structures, somehow empowering folks to do something, that these colonial structures are somehow going to just decide one day that they are going to, you know, hey, everybody, let's get back on the boat. We made a mistake here, and that, like, this is something that isn't going to happen. And so I think for at least for me and a lot of folks like me are quite frustrated with the state of affairs of trying to deal with these colonial structures around the courts and around, because there's no fair shake that's ever going to come out of those courts. There's no fair shake that's ever going to come out of legislation that's going to, you know, grant Indigenous people what we rightly deserve. You know, this country is founded on the rape and theft of our people and from our people. And so if we're going to continue to perpetuate those within the courts, and by honoring the genocide that happened here, by continuing to steal those lands and push settlement on Indigenous lands without any kind of recourse to the Indigenous population that is still here. Like, our people have never gone anywhere. And it's hard for people that experienced residential school, that went through the 60s scoop stuff, you know, and it's further perpetuated now within the criminal context of the massive over-incarceration of Indigenous people. Like, this is, like, these are all the issues that are still being done today. This isn't something of 200 years ago. This is something that is happening now. It is something something can be done about, but it's something that nobody is willing to make a move to do anything.
I think this is the one time that I see a value in the AFM. Because it's a lobby group, if we can get AFN to move on this, at least they get an audience with the federal government. And so that's the one avenue that I could see. The governments always take the view that if we delay long enough, they'll either die off or they'll go away.
That's unbelievably sad to hear, because I've done some advocacy with these people over the past year. I actually did an affidavit for the courts, and we were able to secure an interim payment of $21,000 to some 60s scoop survivors. I myself am a 60s scoop child myself, and it's been incredibly frustrating. And this company known as Collectiva knows they're sitting on the settlement because there's no incentive for them to process these things. And while people from this settlement are able to ask the province for their records, and Collectiva does nothing, like, I don't understand how the colonizers are getting away with this. It's just unbelievable that this is happening. So thank you for your insight, guys. I hope we're able to continue to fight the good fight. I know my political position that I currently hold. I'm working towards getting some answers. I'm talking to certain MPPs locally to get some answers. And there are First Nations like myself, we're willing to fight and we're going to keep fighting. So thank you guys for doing what you guys do and inspiring people like me young enough to keep the fight going.
So Bruce, you kind of hinted that you don't really like the AFN too much, and you know, there's only one way that they could be helpful. And that kind of ties into a question that I prepared in advance here, which was, you know, there's a lot of talk now that the Governor General, Julie Paquette, has stepped down. People are saying, you know, as an act of reconciliation, the Governor General should be an appointed Indigenous person now, and that's going to help resolve the tension between the Canadian state and Indigenous nations on this territory. Maybe a bit of a leading question, but what do both of you think of that whole discourse?
I wonder if any Indigenous person would want to be in that position. Paid by the Crown to represent the Crown is sort of goes against. How can you represent the Crown when you're representing a nation that is in partnership or in relationship with the Crown? You can't do it if you're now representing the Crown. It's like that old two-row wampum. You've hopped out of the canoe and into the ship, and at some point you're going to land in the water.
So yeah, absolutely. You know what? It is absolutely infuriating that we're talking about installing an Indigenous person as that person. Like, and this is the same thing with the UNDRIP stuff. This is the same thing with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Inquiry, the Ipperwash Inquiry, like all of this that continues to be perpetuated by the governments to be able to continue pushing this stuff, all while Indigenous people here, certainly right now, we've been on the land for 193 days and not one word from the federal provincial government to come to the table in any kind of meaningful way, to have any kind of that meaningful dialogue in this like happy Indianness that, you know, we need to somehow just placate these narrative around how we need to reconcile. And like how can you reconcile for the absolute genocide of our people? How can you push these agendas forward, talking about how we are going to do these nation-to-nation relationships when we're talking about like the only relationship that we've had with the state so far has come at the point of a gun, have come at the point of seeing, you know, the police and their intelligence people and their provincial liaison team members come into our community to try and advance those divisions that have been used in our communities for 100, 200 years to try and divide us as nations. And so, you know what, I'm sorry for being a little incensed, but it's infuriating for a lot of folks to be having these discussions around what those, how we can further assimilate Indigenous people into Western Canadian, whatever society, so that we are just, you know, another cog in the wheel. And for me and for my family and for most folks that, at Landback Lane, I can obviously say like that is not something that we are interested in.
Right, and it's my fault because I asked the question that brought out that incense there. But that's kind of my job, so I'm going to keep doing that. Skyler, you talked a lot about your experience with the police at Landback Lane, and I just wanted to turn that to Bruce or to any Indigenous people in the audience today. Do you have any insights on what Indigenous people are experiencing in relation to police in Guelph? And I also wanted to say, you know, if anybody in the audience is uncomfortable saying something out loud or contributing to that by identifying themselves, then you can send me a private message in the Zoom chat and then I'll say it verbatim for you. But Bruce, if you want to maybe start. Then.
Yeah, I'm not hearing a lot. A few friends have spoken up that there are issues. I'm sure there are, but the only point I would make is that about 4 years ago, I approached the police about doing the blanket exercise as a beginning point for some cultural understanding of how to deal with Indigenous people rather than just the point of the gun, as Skylar has said. I was given all manner of assurances that someone would get back to me, and I'm sure they will someday, but they haven't in the last 4 years. So,
okay, thank you, Bruce. And I see in the chat that Shiko, you said that you can speak on that. So Shiko, would you like to maybe introduce yourself and then go into that?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Shiko Mar. I am Indigenous. I'm Nahua and adopted Anishinaabe, and I live in Guelph because I'm a youth and I hang out downtown a lot. I've seen a lot with the police. Thankfully, like, none of my interactions with the police have been bad, I don't think, because I'm Indigenous. It's because of other stuff. So for me personally, I've been fine, thank God. But I have a lot of friends. I have a brother downtown who's been homeless for a while, and he's from Nunavut. And, you know, first of all, like, everyone think Inuit people and Anishinaabe people do not look alike, right? But there's other Native guys downtown who are like around the same height kind of, and they're just tall and Native, and the cops constantly confuse them. And when they're trying to arrest one guy, they've almost beat up my friend, my brother, over confusing him with someone else. And it is a consistent issue where they literally cannot tell Native people apart. And they specifically target homeless Native people. In Guelph, we have bylaws about about outdoor fires and stuff. And I know my homeless friends always get by the police for having outdoor fires. It's especially infuriating for Indigenous people. It's like, are you kidding me? We can't have fires on the land. We're hungry. We're cold. We're tired. Like, how are we supposed to survive? A lot of shelters in Guelph don't really have Indigenous specific programming or services. So you're just in a mainstream shelter. And a lot of times, like, if you're coming from way up north, or you're coming from a community up north, like, it's such a culture shock down here when you somehow, I don't know why people end up in Guelph, but when people eventually end up in Guelph, like, there's just no services to really properly take care of them all the way outside of, we have a few services, but, you know, those are stretched really thin. And then it's just like the cops just don't get it. They do not understand. They don't understand how to talk with us. They don't understand any of the sensitivities. Ultimately, the laws they're upholding are always just going to be unfair to us. Those laws are fit for white people. And even then, they're not even that good for them. But for Native people, it's like, none of our nations operate on those kind of laws. How are we supposed to understand these? How are we supposed to abide by these? And so, thankfully, yeah, for me, I haven't heard anything. Like, I haven't experienced any, like, brutality. But I have friends, there's been some really close calls where, like, it's gone scary. So we're like, I think it's because we have such a small population in Guelph. So yeah, it could get worse because, like, things are getting worse in Guelph where the police are trying to get more money and they're kind of taking a more militarized approach. So honestly, like, we had a big rally on July 1st and it was with the intention of, like, we're not going to wait for someone to die. We want this done now. You know, I don't want to wait for someone to die in Guelph. I don't want to wait for someone to get the kicked out of them. So that's kind of where we're at. I hope that answered everyone's question.
That question and more. Thanks, Shiko, for sharing. Really appreciate having you here. I think we lost Bruce. I'm not sure what's going on. Maybe a tech issue on his end. So Skylar, you're riding solo for a little bit until Bruce gets back. Knowing that, I'll ask one of the questions that was addressed to you. And this one's from Mandy. Mandy's question was, hi, Skylar. Nice to see you. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on why the cops haven't just come in and hauled you all out. Do you think it's because the state knows that you have the right to be there? They're afraid of the response from folks at Lambeck Lane or the wider community, or of stoking a wider solidarity movement, or of losing in court and setting a precedent? Or do they just not want the bad press that comes with kicking Indigenous people off of their land? And last question from Mandy, this land reclamation has been going on for ages. What's your secret?
Hi, Mandy. And yes. So yes, 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 and yes are the short answers to all of those. I think the bad press would absolutely be horrible for the OPP right now. I think the ability for the police to be able to enforce stuff right now, the scope and the scale of that is huge. I think the fear around there being, you know, another Oka, another Iprawash, another situation where, you know, like, because that's the thing is, and, you know, I've talked about this before, is it's always the indigenous people that end up. It doesn't matter where you are, from East Coast to West Coast, it's always us that ends up, you know, with a gun pointed at us, with, you know, a cop that doesn't know that pulls the trigger in the wrong instance. And so when we talk about these issues around the policing, like, I take it very, very seriously. And so, like, those, the idea of having, you know, 200, 300 cops down here to enforce something that, you know, like the last time we had, you know, 300, 400, 500 people come out, you know, 06, we had 1,000 people come out to, you know, take back the land after the OPP came in that day. And so it is a difficult situation, to say the least. But at the same time, like, our community has stepped up in such huge ways over and over and over again, and have shown that resilience. And I think, to the last question, that's exactly what it is to be able to have that massive swell of community, those clan structures that we were talking about earlier, the Confederacy chiefs and the hereditary system talking with us on, you know, all the time, and supporting that, like, these are the secrets, is that building of community. And that's something that we've done a lot of work to try and do over the last, you know, 6 months, to make sure that we are building those relationships. We've got a ton of support from ally networks everywhere. Somebody asked me the other day about, like, well, what should allies do? I went to say something, and I stopped myself, and I'm like, well, what can you do? You know, like, what is your capacity? You know, like, if you got, you know, you got kids, you got a job, you got this, you got things that you, like, that you need to do. Absolutely. You know, like, for some people that's, you know, like, live on a fixed income, you know, send $20 to the camp, you know, come down, bring a plate of hot food if you have a car that you can get it here. There's one girl that came here on the very first day with us, and she just stayed. She showed up the first day and has been here for, you know, all of those 193 days. And so it's been an amazing gift to be able to build that family and friends that we are at Lineback Lane. And so, like, if, you know, your capacity is to come down and help and build and cook and do, you know, all of the stuff that, you know, keeps the camp going forward, then right on. Absolutely. This is that secret, is just to build that community. And I think for me anyways, like, I knew I was, as the spokesperson, I got the nod this time. I mean, and so that is all that was. And so, like, I'm not the leader, I'm not the anything other than just the spokesperson. And so, like, the idea that, like, I'm, you know, part of this collective of folks that care, that want to see our rights upheld. And so, like, making sure that we're always doing everything that we can to, you know, take everybody's voices and put that into a pretty little bow and throw that at you guys and at the, you know, at the, yeah, and whatever. And so we've done everything we can to try and manage those relationships as best as we can.
Awesome. Thank you, Skylar. So, Bruce, there was a question addressed to you, and it's from Councillor Gordon. Bruce, can you speak to the way that you see the city of Guelph currently dealing with the Indigenous community on a quote unquote government to government level? Why can that be less effective?
Well, when they talk nation to nation or government to government, then obviously they're talking about the Mississaugas of the Credit or Six Nations, and it eliminates the local people, because we're not easily seen as a government or a nation. As I said earlier, we're a mixed bag here. And for them to tick off the boxes of did we consult, it's much easier to do it that way, to consult with another governance system that looks similar. It's those elected chiefs and councils are the pyramid that fits so well with municipal pyramids. So I think it's easier and it takes more work. And that's why I've said it before to council, build on the relationships you've already begun. Don't try and restart something. Just build on what you already have.
Thanks to all who participated. And to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gevert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Hour is by Jules Germ. Editing is by Anya Eland. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thank you for listening.